Very happy to be with you here. Is the next to last speaker. My German accent qualifies me for an additional 5 minutes or 10 minutes. In any case, to everything that Professor Reichow has left over. But we economists are used to live off the breadcrumbs that the historians leave under the table. I'm also grateful to Professor Reichow that he has completed, in a way, our program, which was prosperity, war, and depression. Yesterday we talked about prosperity, this morning about war, and then Professor Reichow brought us, at the end, the depressive state of American politics. So otherwise, I would have had the unthankful task of being depressive, but so I can spare myself all this and then turn to one of the purposes of this meeting, that is to get to the summit. And the summit is undoubtedly present if we talk about, well, nice things such as the life of Ludwig von Mises, so it will certainly become critical this afternoon. Just to remind the students of Professor Reichow, this is the eastern part of the American Empire. But at a time when it was still a loose branch office. So what we have here is the state of Austria, which was at the time the second largest political entity in Europe, next only to Russia. So it was far bigger than France and Spain and Sweden. And by the way, here you see that a multicultural political entity here, today called Germany. At the time, there was no such thing as Germany. There was true multiculturalism. There were Prussians and Hessians and Bavarians and Rhinelanders and whatever else. And meanwhile, you see the impact of government homogenization processes with just one state left. Now, turning more closely to Austria, so this was the country. Oh, yeah. And Mises lived here in this part of the country, which was Galicia. The country had come under the Austrian crown at the end of the 18th century when Poland was divided between Prussia, Russia, and Austria, and was predominantly inhabited by Jews. Mises' family were also Jewish, and they lived in the capital of Lemberg. So why do I tell you this? Well, because I think it's important to keep in mind that certainly size of one's fatherland has something to do with the self-feeling and so on of young people when they're raised. And so Mises was raised in the consciousness of belonging to this very large political entity, even though his own region had become only recently part of this. And he lived. So how did Galicia look like? Well, so that's beautiful, right? You could say almost Arkansas or something. Beautiful sky. They had even clouds there. Cannot believe it. Nice lakes and so on. Sorry, I couldn't get much more. That was the only photo of the landscape that I found. But I found more for you of the city itself. So this is how Lemberg looks today. Nothing spectacular. But this is also how it looks still today. And it gives you more of a notion of how it looks like. So it looks rather charming, right? So what you see here, the architecture is Baroque and Renaissance. It's still very well preserved. One of the great blessings of communism, which is ultimately is the ultimate inefficient economic system, is that they never had the money to tear everything down and build it up again. That is why Western Germany, well, not all of it, but large parts are very ugly, because they had the money to destroy everything that the war had left over. In some cities, these destruction, by the way, amounted to or were larger than the war destructions themselves. Right? So speaking of government programs, when they only have the money. So here, this was not the case, and we have this beautiful square. This is the Reynolds square. So you can imagine Mises as a young boy running around. It's certainly exactly how it looked in his time. Then we have here another square. This is the Ascension Square. You see by the name already, it was a Catholic city. Nice Catholic Baroque city. Looks quite spectacular. And of course you had churches. This is the St. George Cathedral, also Baroque. And it's very well preserved. So, I mean, they must have had at least some government money to upkeep the buildings. This is the so-called Chapel of Boehmes. I don't even know whether I pronounce it correctly. I will add something to the work of art of Professor Reiko. So it's the Chapel of, that's how it's spelled. And it's a famous piece of art in Eastern Europe. One of the things that is interesting and noteworthy is that you have a sitting Christ here. So Christ is not on the cross, he's sitting at the cross. And of course the facade itself, rich artwork and so on. Okay, now that's some street life. Visibly not the late 19th century. It was not the Victorian fashion. But again, right, so the streets have certainly not changed in appearance since then. Yeah, and then we have these are Jewish schoolboys at the end of the 19th century in Lemberg. It says here, Judenschüler in Lemberg. It's Jewish pupils in Lemberg. I mean, there were hardly any other pupils at the time in Lemberg, but so I think that's a group photo. And some of the Jewish pupils we can imagine were these three. Right. So in here we get to the heart of our matter. And that's a group photo of Mises with his two brothers. Right. The one in the middle, the tall boy, the oldest one, that was Ludwig von Mises. Young man on the left side is his brother Richard. And this young man did not survive, so he died shortly after the photo was taken. So there were originally three. I don't know. Yeah. Sorry that you asked. Well, I forgot it more precisely. Yeah. So they spent approximately the first 10 years or so of their life in Lemberg. I don't know in which street they live, but maybe we can imagine. So that's a mansion in Lemberg that exists still today, which already existed in that period. So we can imagine, I mean, why not, right? The Mises family was a big family. They could have lived in such a house. Right? They were certainly belonged to the richer strata of the population, so they had a representative building. They always had personnel. And even when the family moved to Vienna, they also had personnel. So at least a cook and a housemaid. And this remained so until the time when Mises' mother died. So the cook and the housemaid remained with the mother until she died in 1938, at which point Mises sublet the apartment. He just kept one room for himself where he stored all his books and his personal documents, and the apartment itself went to somebody else. Okay. But that is just to say, I mean, so Mises, you get an inadequate image of, well, Mises and how Mises lived and so on if you just consider, his living conditions in New York City. Okay, it was a nice apartment on West End Avenue, but it was a three-bedroom or two-bedroom apartment. They had no cook, right? Margaret had to do all the cooking herself and so on. So they lived, in much more feudal circumstances. Now, of course, I mention all these things because they are critical, be it only for the reason that the first impressions on any human being are usually also the most lasting impressions. And therefore, also the first critical episode in Mises' life was certainly to be raised in this town and in this family. Right, so here we have another picture of the family. This is the mother, Mises' father, and then the three boys again. And certainly the most important person in Mises' life, as possibly in everybody's life, was the mother. And this lady was truly remarkable. I mean, the fact is, well, that certainly, as we know, Mises was a genius, so if you raised one genius, but she didn't have a genius and a bum, but she had two geniuses, actually, because Richard was at least as famous in his lifetime as Ludwig, possibly more famous. So Richard was a pioneer of aviation theory. He wrote and published in 1914 a book on aviation theory, Fluglehre, that was the German title. And the book was published in five or six editions until the 1950s. It was a standard work for four decades. And he also pioneered thermodynamics, the theory of fluids. Was at a very young age, much earlier than Ludwig, became a professor at an Austrian university and then at the University of Strasbourg, which at the time was again in the German Reich. And after the war, so at this time Ludwig, I mean 1909, Richard was already a professor, a full professor of physics, and Ludwig had not even gotten his habilitation degree, which qualified the people to postulate for such a position. And after the war, then Richard was a colleague of Albert Einstein's and Heisenberg's and others at the University of Berlin, the most famous physics department in the world. And then moved to Turkey after Hitler came to power, and then shortly before the war broke out, came to Harvard and spent there the rest of his life. Died in 1954. So this lady here raised two such men. I mean, it's quite an accomplishment. So certainly, I mean, Ludwig was lucky to have this mother, and we can only imagine what would have happened if the third brother had survived, although you can never know. Right? Maybe he would have been a great war leader or something like this, or a great politician. God forbid. Yeah. Maybe just to tell, so Mises had always a close relationship with the mother until the very end. Richard fell a little bit from grace when he converted to Catholicism around the outbreak of World War I. He was a good friend of Rilke's, a famous poet, and actually also published two articles on Rilke. So he was, as I said, a great expert in applied mathematics, but he also was an art expert, so he was a recognized authority in literature. There is not any correspondence out of which I could quote, unfortunately, of these early days. Also, but there is correspondence between Mises and his mother from the war, and from this correspondence, well, it shows itself. This lady was very clear in the head and. Always very practical and pragmatic. There's nothing bombastic in her way of expressing herself, always clear, so you see what the background came from. And so just to give you an idea how she cared for him, so she sent him to the front the following items: furred leather gloves, electric lamps, matches, shoelaces, woolen clothes, camel hair pants, camel hair undergloves, pain relievers, cigarettes, glasses and jaw notes, Ludwig's favorite brand of suspenders, eau de toilette, soap, cognac, and tuna cans. Right? And she was an accountant, I tell you. She got lists of all the things that she sent him, controlled punctual delivery, and she also controlled the consumption of her son. Right? She wouldn't send him too many cigarettes. Smoke too much. Yeah, then the family moved to Vienna. That's the picture of the school, how it looked like in those days. And after school, I don't have any pictures of the teachers, But I have a picture of his first professor at the University of Jena. That is Karl Grünberg. And Grünberg was one of the young champions. That is, he wasn't that young anymore, but probably this picture was from the 1920s. But at the time, so he was in his early 40s, and he was a young champion of the historical school of economics. And so the school in opposition to which the Austrian school around Karl Menger had gained prominence. So Mises then started off, in fact, as a pupil of this representative of the historical school, and Mises himself showed in his first published work that he was a great disciple of this movement. So he wrote a book on the relationship between lords and peasants in his native Galicia from the 14th century to the revolution of 1848. And then applied the method that Grünberg and Karl Knapp had pioneered in their work. The method consisted in going into archives, reading all the documents, and then writing them together. Right? So strictly after the application of the maxim, if you quote one author, or if you repeat what one author says, it's plagiarism. If you quote 15 of them, it's research. Yeah, in Grünberg's seminar, Hans Kelsen, somebody he met already in school. I don't have time to talk about him. After attending Grünberg seminars and following all other classes for 2 years, Mises spent a military service of 1 year approximately. So that was the first time he underwent the beneficial influence of being raised in the spirit of patriotism and discipline. He learned all the things that you can only learn at the military. I hope he didn't catch syphilis. So this photo showed him probably in 1902 or 1903. And it's a picture taken probably in the garden of the Hofburg, right? the castle where the Austrian emperor lived in the middle of Vienna. The garden was public. So people going around. I don't know who this young man here is, but Mises was obviously, as you see, right? So he was very happy and proud to wear the uniform, which some 10 years later he would wear for quite a substantial time. Now, when he quit, shortly after he quit the army, so it was a one-year service, his father died. The father died. And in this critical point of time, Mises immediately found another, well, at least spiritual father, spiritual authority. When he came across the book of this man, the title of Grundsätze der Volkswirtschaftslehre, Principles of Economics, and this is Karl Menger, of course. So it was really a few months after the father died that Mises, by some chance, came across Menger's book, which was his initiation to economic theory. And this reading experience turned him away from the historical school. So before he had just been exposed to the, well, we could say propaganda, or let's say so the one-sided exposition of the point of view of the historical school, which said, okay, all theory is just crap, and it's invention, figments, and so on. And here in Karl Menger's work, he discovered, well, economic theory, or social theory, or whatever else you want to call this, is more than that. It's not just a collection of arbitrary hypotheses and so on, fictitious assumptions. No, it's something that really describes a part of reality that historical research cannot cover. Right? It's something that we can only, there are things that we can only learn by reflecting, by reasoning itself, by logic, and which we cannot find in the archives. And these things that we find by reasoning are crucial to understand human action, and they are crucial to make the right policy decisions. Now, we can imagine that it was not 1 month after he read the book that he knew all this, right? So, I mean, he was not the author of Human Action in January 1904, right? So he read Menger around Christmas 1903. But it was the starting point of an intellectual process that lasted several years. and was reinforced by his encounter of this man, which is Eugen von Böhm-Bawerk, foremost disciple of Menger, and whose seminar Mises attended from 1905 through the very end, that is, until the war broke out in 1914. Böhm-Bawerk. We have his books here on sale, I believe, Capital and Interest, and it's in the library anyway. Yeah, I will skip the war years and move directly to the time after the year, where Mises again met somebody who had some impact on him. This man was directly, for most of the 1920s, Austrian Chancellor. The name is Monsignor Seitz. He was a priest, Catholic priest, and when he came to the government, so the first governments of Austria and Republican Austria, in 1918 the old monarchy was abolished, then a new Republican regime was installed. The first governments, the first two governments were socialist governments. And then after the socialist euphoria had a little bit worn out, because the results were, so they didn't quite live up to their word, not surprisingly, so other people came to power, and the Christian Social Party, that was the name of his party, brought Seitz, or elected Seitz as a chancellor. Now, why is this important? Because Mises, in his book Socialism, which he first published in 1922, has a chapter on Christianity in which he is rather severe. The interesting, he says, well, there's nothing in whatever Jesus said and so on that is suitable to maintain a free society or a capitalistic society. So there's, he really constructed, he painted an image of Christianity that was antagonistic to liberty, to capitalism, liberalism. And so it's probably one of the weakest pieces that he wrote, in my judgment at least. And then in the second edition of 1932, he somehow modified his final verdict, made it much less severe, more equilibrated, when he said, okay, but maybe there would be a possibility to reconcile it, namely if the Catholic Church decided herself to adopt in the political field the program of liberalism, of classical liberalism. So now there's the question, what brought him to change his mind? And I think one of the influences was this man, the Chancellor of Austria, with whom Mises cooperated very closely in the early 1920s, whom he convinced bring about a monetary reform. Austria had a very large, very high inflation that raged in 1922. And Mises, in consulting with Seitz, brought him to, well, impose a monetary reform. Seitz then also gave Mises, made Mises one of the presidents of this Bureau for the Settlement of Government Debts, where he met Hayek. And for those of you who know the story on how Mises met Hayek, was in a government bureau. And it was Seitz who made Mises the president of this bureau in 1922. So obviously there was very close interaction here and respect. And then after World War II, when the intellectual maturity process had continued a little bit longer, Mises would actually write something like this in correspondence with a high clergyman of the Church of England in Canada. So Mises wrote to him, "I fully agree with your statement that the Gospels do not advocate anti-capitalistic policies." It's the exact opposite of what he had written in the book. Then he says, "I dealt with this problem years ago in my book Socialism. I furthermore fully agree with your proposition that one does not find in human action," is the book, Human Action, "one word which is in opposition to the Christian faith." So that's quite a long way that he has come, and this man was the first Once he was in the United States, so this letter was written in 1950, once he was in the United States, he met other men, in particular Protestant clergymen, but also just Protestant faithful, who were both lovers of liberty and Christians, and who brought him to change his mind on these things by their example. Now, in the mid-1920s, was another fateful encounter. Namely, met this lady. Oh, yeah. She was a beauty. 5 feet 4 inches, brown hair, gray-blue eyes. She was an actress, was charming and everything, and even if she did not feel like being charming, she could be charming. She was an actress. And this is how she described Mises when they met one evening in 1925 in the apartment of Felix Kaufmann, who was a member of Mises' seminar. So Mises probably must have looked something like this. Not bad. Oh, what impressed me were his beautiful clear blue eyes. Always concentrated on the person to whom he talked, never shifting away. Now you can imagine what that meant when Mises talked to politicians. His dark hair, already a little grayish at the sides, was parted. Not one hair out of place. I liked his hands. Well, we cannot see them here. Long, slim fingers, which clearly showed that he did not use them for manual work. He was dressed with quiet elegance, a dark, custom-made suit, a fitting silk necktie. His posture indicated that he must have been a former army officer. Yeah, so that was the beginning of the love affair, but characteristically, Mises did not lose his presence of mind, even when feelings of love overwhelmed him. Could he trust an actress? Margit herself later pointed out that in those days, most people in good society considered actresses as a better class of call girls. Ludwig, too, was apparently not quite free from prejudice. At any rate, he took his precautions. As he later confessed to his wife, he had checked some of her statements about her professional development by looking up all the records on the question in the archives of the local newspaper. The result of his investigation confirmed Margit's version of things. But there were more fundamental obstacles in 1925 that hampered the development of their romance into partnership, obstacles rooted in Ludwig's philosophical views about the nature of marriage and the possibility of combining it with his intellectual projects. Now, I'm quoting one thoroughly unromantic passage from Socialism. It says it all. As a social institution, marriage... Sorry, I cannot say it with an Austrian accent, but I'll work on this. As a social institution, marriage is an adjustment of the individual to the social order by which a certain field of activity, with all its tasks and requirements, is assigned to him. I can imagine if you start like this to your future wife. I mean. Exceptional natures, whose abilities lift them far above the average, cannot support the coercion which such an adjustment to the way of life of the masses must involve. Coercion. Uh-oh. The man who feels within himself the urge to devise and achieve great things, who is prepared to sacrifice his life rather than to be false to his mission, will not stifle his urge for the sake of a wife and children. Yeah, clearly, he was not fit for marriage. In the life of a genius, however loving, the woman and whatever goes with her occupy a small place. We do not speak here of those great men in whom sex was completely sublimated and turned into other channels, Kant, for example, or of those whose fiery spirit, insatiable in the pursuit of love, could not acquiesce in the inevitable disappointments of married life and hurried with restless urge from one passion to another. Okay. Even the man of genius whose married life seems to take a normal course whose attitude to sex does not differ from that of other people cannot in the long run feel himself bound by marriage without violating his own self. Genius does not allow itself to be hindered by any consideration for the comfort of his fellows, even of those closest to it. The ties of marriage become intolerable bonds, which the genius tries to cast off, or at least to loosen, so as to be able to move freely. The married couple must walk side by side amid the rank and file of humanity. Ooh. Whoever wishes to go his own way must break away from it. Rarely indeed is he granted the happiness of finding a woman willing and able to go with him on a solitary path. Now, eventually, she walked with him on the solitary path, right? So they married 13 years later, right? So some maturity process involved. And then we have, I mean, if you look at the book of Margit von Mises, My Years with Ludwig von Mises, in the middle there's a section with all the photographs, find lots of wonderful photos where they are in the mountains. And it's really the illustration, right? Granted the happiness of finding a woman willing and able to go with him on the solitary path, right? So then they're on the Alp mountain paths walking through the rocks. Yeah, so it was not an easy encounter. But they did it. Yeah. Then the next critical episode that I've selected has to do with this man. This is not the American ambassador in Afghanistan. This is Heinrich Himmler. So in March 1938, Himmler visited Vienna in preparation of the invasion of the German army, which took place on the following day. And he was the head of an advance commando that took on, well, the number 1 to 10 of the on the list of enemies. So they went to the apartments, sought them out, and so on, captured them. And either on this day or on the next, Mises' apartment was captured too, was invaded. They took everything away from it, all the books, everything that belonged to Mises. The books, personal documents, all the files, destroyed furniture, so whatever they could not take with them, like the vandals. Thanks to this, we found many years later virtually a complete complete set of these files were rediscovered in Moscow, and we have a copy of them today here at the Mises Institute. So these files that were stolen in 1938 in the context of the German invasion into Austria, German takeover of Austria, were later recovered and now, well, form an essential basis for my biographical work. Still, I hesitate to say thank you, Heinrich. Next critical event then was some 2 years later. This man here. It's not the head of the chief of staff, the American forces, but this man was Heinz Guderian. And he was significant because he overthrew Mises' theory of how the war would be waged between the Western powers and Germany. Mises was entirely convinced that the German army would be stopped on the Rhine. So therefore he was quiet, was in Geneva, Switzerland, didn't feel threatened. He wrote even to his friend, the American Benjamin Anderson, invited him to come to Europe. Here's, I just read a little bit from the correspondence, it's quite funny. So Anderson wrote to Mises, oh, March 1940, right? So the war has been going on for a few months, but it not yet reached the Western Front. And Anderson writes, my plan would be to come first to Italy, work up through Switzerland into France, then come to Belgium and the Netherlands, probably going to England by air, either from the Netherlands or from Paris. Mises writes back, I have a feeling that coming to Europe at this time, even to the neutral states, is almost like going to a friend. Mises wrote, okay, your doubts about a visit in Europe are completely unfounded, right? It is just the right time for you to come and to see what is going on. That was written in response to this, sometimes in April 1940. Yeah, and then at the beginning of May, the tank division of Guderian rolled over all of Belgium and rolled all over France. So within 3 weeks, they had stampeded the enemy armies and also destroyed Mises' illusions about how the war would be waged. So they had to emigrate to the United States. And here, most notably, he met this man, Henry Hazlitt, whose encouragement and advice and so on, he would probably not have published his first books in the U.S., Bureaucracy, Omnipotent Government, and Human Action, and who certainly was instrumental in making Human Action the success that it turned out to become. But Mises also had the good fortune to, well, not to become directly acquainted with, but to be helped by this man, whose name is William Faulkner. William Faulkner. William Faulkner was born in Germany and came to the U.S. in the late 19th century. Set up a company and became very rich in the Midwest, and then got married late in his life when he was more than 40 years old already, and then due to the influence of his wife became a philanthropist. So one of the things that he financed shortly before his death in the late 1940s was the burgeoning libertarian movement in the U.S. So he financed, for example, the first Mont Pelerin Society meeting in 1947. Right? And he also, in the foundation that he had set up, the William Faulkner Fund, financed seminars given by Mises, lecture tours, students, scholarships, and so on. So this man did, in those days, pretty much what many of you are doing today. Right? And without his help, too, right? The Mises Revolution or the Mises movement of the 1950s would not have been possible. The William Faulkner Fund worked under the inspiration also of this man. This is a photo of the time shortly before he died. This is Herbert C. Cornwell, and he was one of the executives of the William Faulkner Fund in those days, in the late 1940s and early 1950s. And it was Faulkner who picked the man who would, in fact, later on be the chief maintaining the Misesian paradigm during the dark years of the 1950s and 60s and 70s, and without whom the Mises Institute would be unthinkable, namely this young man. Right? Cornell's idea when seeing the manuscript of Human Action was, okay, that's a great book, but that's far too intellectual for the American public. So we need to have a boiled down version. Who could write this? Right? And then he had met this brilliant young student. He must have been 10 years younger about than on this photo, and got Rothbard to write such a boiled down version. And Rothbard later on said, after having read Human Action, I had a definite instinctive feeling or insight or whatever there was something wrong with all the schools of economics. I was very unhappy with all the economic theory. I thought that the institutionalists, when they were criticizing the orthodox, were right. And when the orthodox people were criticizing the institutionalists, they were right too. The criticisms were right, and I believed that the simple supply and demand stuff was correct, but I didn't really have a good theoretical base. I wasn't happy with any theories offered, and then when I read Human Action, the whole thing just slipped into place because everything made sense. So it's pretty much, it sums up the experience that virtually all readers have when they come to reading Human Action after having been educated on other grounds. So again, that was certainly a critical period. Everything came together, and there was a foremost intellectual. There were people ready to support this financially. There were other people ready to and capable to organize things, right? And there were young people, right, willing to take up the work where the other ones had left it, and then continue for several decades. Well, that's pretty much what we are doing too, and well, I hope it will continue to be so for a long time. Thank you.